mathematics and complex numbers, unitary transformations, and the physical origin remains obscure, even though quantum theory was formulated a long time ago. And over the last 15 or 20 years, several physicists have proposed the idea that information may be the key missing ingredient in our understanding of quantum theory, specifically that it may be possible to use the quantum information to actually derive the quantum formalism and thereby gain a deeper understanding of these features. So in this talk, I'll describe an attempt to explore this possibility. And the approach is, the idea is to formulate some kind of information theoretic principle and a set of physical assumptions and show how this leads to the quantum formalism, the finite dimensional quantum formalism. Now, at the outset, it's, I think, very useful just to ask why information? Why would we think that information might play such a fundamental role in our understanding of quantum theory? And there are more than one possible answer that one could give to this question, but this particular argument is the one I find most convincing. In classical physics, if an experimenter is given a system in some unknown state, he can perform a measurement on the system which provides complete knowledge of the state of the system. So that basically there's no distinction between state on the one hand and the ideal experimental's knowledge of the state. Now, in quantum theory, there's a difference. There's a fundamental difference here. If you're presented with a system in an unknown state, even performing an ideal measurement, one can only gain finite amount of information about the state. And even if you analyze a finite number of such systems, you would only gain a finite number of amount of information about the state. And if you assume that indeed an experimenter can only fundamentally perform a finite number of measurements in a finite amount of time, a fundamental distinction becomes drawn between the state of the system on the one hand and the experimenter's knowledge of it. And the concept of information then enters as a means to relate the two things. So the most natural instinct we have is to say, well, can we quantify? Can we quantify the amount of information the experimenter has gained about the state? So this is how information can enter into the picture at a fundamental level. And it supports the idea that it would be very fruitful, potentially, to explore the process of information gain to quantify it and to see maybe that can bear upon the question of where these mysterious features of quantum theory come from. Now, over the last 10 to 15 years, there have been a number of attempts to derive aspects of a quantum formalism from informational ideas. And it's useful to categorize the approaches into two main types. In the first type, largely due to Wouters, Bruckner, and Sumhammer, the approaches are characterized by making very relatively few physically comprehensible assumptions. So the approaches are very conservative in that sense. And they impose an informational principle which conserves the amount of information obtained when a measurement is performed on a system. And in all three cases, the authors obtain Malus's law. And they all try to push forward these ideas in some way, to try to obtain something more of the abstract quantum formalism. But they're really not able to obtain any significant part of the formalism. The second type of approach takes a different tack. Right at the outset, they make abstract assumptions, which typically involve introducing the complex number field right at the beginning. For example, Clifton et al. Use the C-star algebraic framework, which obviously involves complex numbers. And Ariel Katicha's approach involves trying to derive Feynman's rules for combining probability amplitudes. And his starting point is to associate experimentally testable propositions, to associate complex numbers with experimentally testable propositions. In other words, he takes that as a starting point. So complex numbers introduced right at the beginning. But the payoff of making these abstract assumptions at the beginning is that these authors are all able to obtain a significant fraction of the quantum formalism, which gives us some confidence that it isn't foolhardy to try to do something like this. So let me just describe Wouters' approach, because I think it's the most striking of the first type of approach. And it's my approach, actually, in a sense, you could say, is a development of this basic idea. Now, Waters considers an experimental arrangement where Alice tries to transmit information about theta, which is the theta here, to Bob using spin-half systems. So the idea is Alice prepares, say, silver atoms using this Stern Gerlach device here. The silver atoms are passed to Bob, who uses this Stern Gerlach device. And the state of the prepared spin can be written in terms of P1 and P2, where P1 and P2 are the outcome probabilities of this measurement here. And quantum theory tells us that P and theta are related like so. Hence, by analyzing n spins, Bob learns about F1, the frequency of outcome 1. Therefore, he learns about P1, and therefore about theta. Now, what Waters does at this point is very interesting. He says, well, suppose we didn't know quantum theory. What function of P1 of theta would somehow maximize the amount of information that Bob gains about theta in n runs of the experiment? And I'm stating the principle very qualitatively here. There are lots of small detailed distinctions that one has to make to state it precisely. But out of this, remarkably, he obtains a generalized form of Malice's law. But as I said, when he tries to push this forward, he is not able to really get very far. But it's a very promising little argument, which shows that it seems like there's something in it. The thick question is whether we can push this forward. Now, the approach is, so trying now to formulate a strategy for going forward. The approaches that I've just described support the view, I think, that information has an important role to play in understanding quantum theory. I think Waters' approach particularly, because it's so conservative in its assumptions. The approaches of the second type, in a sense, the success of the approaches, on the other hand, shows the weakness of the approach. That is to say, even if you manage to derive the quantum formalism by making these abstract assumptions, by allowing yourself to make these abstract assumptions at the outset, at the end of the day, one has very limited understanding of the quantum formalism. If you introduce complex numbers at the beginning, then you've already introduced a very mysterious feature of quantum theory into your formulation at the beginning. So obviously that's going to limit the understanding you obtain. So what we're going to try to do is to see how far we can go sticking only to physically comprehensible assumptions. So just kind of trying to push that forward.
So what does physically comprehensible mean?
Next slide. Okay, so physically comprehensible is a very vague term. And so it's actually very helpful and important to sort of distinguish degrees of understanding. What do we mean by understanding? And I've only distinguished two levels here. You can probably I privately distinguish about four levels, two more levels than this. But the basic level is that we understand something transparently as an assertion about physical events. So I call this transparency. And the next level of understanding would be traceability. So you've got some assumption, and we can trace it back to some combination of experimental facts and plausible theoretical principles. So historical example, in Einstein's derivation of the Lorentz transformations. The speed of light postulate is transparent. We can understand it as an assertion about the results of a definite experimental procedure. There's no mystery in that. We may not intuitively agree with it, or we may find it very strange, but we can understand it at that level. It's transparent. And we can also understand it at the level of traceability. We can see where it comes from. It comes from the Michelson-Morley experiment, generalized in the light of some principle of the uniformity of nature. So we would like our postulates to have at least these two levels of physical comprehensibility. So the postulates that we'll draw will be from three distinct sources. First of all, drawn from the theoretical framework of classical physics, either sort of directly, we're talking about some fundamental assumptions of classical physics here. And if we need to make assumptions about probability and information, how do you quantify information, I'm asserting that we will try to be conservative and draw only upon established standard probability theory and Shannon's theory of information, rather than, for example, using non-standard information measures. And secondly, We will draw upon experimental facts that we regard as characteristic of quantum phenomena. Again, experimental facts are something we can agree on even if we don't understand at a deeper level, so it seems like a secure basis for assumptions. And three, based on assumptions based on other plausible novel theoretical principles. For example, something like Waters' principle of information maximization. So that's where perhaps novel informational principles would enter. Now, the formulation consists of three main parts. First of all, basic notions which let us get started. So background assumptions, which are elementary definitions of system, background, and state, which are needed for theoretical modeling even to begin, which are these assumptions that are just drawn from classical physics. And then idealizations, which are very important because they constrain right away what we mean by a measurement, or what properties it should have, for example. And then an abstract setup, which gives a precise description of an abstract idealized experimental setup. And the most important feature of this is that it's theory independent. So we're not using the concept of pure state to define an abstract setup. We're saying we don't know quantum theory, so we can't help ourselves to such notions. And then postulates. The postulates determine the theoretical model of the abstract setup. In other words, that defines the abstract quantum formalism. And then there's an additional principle, the arbitrary correspondence principle, which allows a derivation of the formal rules, such as operator rules, commutation relations, and so on, that are needed to derive particular experimental setups. And in this talk, I won't be talking about that additional principle, unfortunately, at all. Okay, the background assumptions are drawn from classical physics, and they're very simple. Partitioning, that we can still partition the universe into a system, a background with which it interacts, a measuring apparatus for the rest of the universe. And we can talk about time, as we do in classical physics, which is common to the background and the system. And that we can also still maintain this idea of physical state, so that even in the quantum realm, we can still talk about the state of a physical system. None of these are necessarily trivial when we're moving away from classical physics, but there doesn't seem any obvious reason to jettison any of them. So to be conservative, we hold on to all three. Now, idealizations concern, first of all, measurements. We are assuming the measurements we idealize measurements such that they have the following properties. Finiteness, which is to say that measurements yield one of a finite number of possible outcomes. So here we're saying we don't accept the idea of a measurement yielding a continuum of possible outcomes. So we're making a decision here. And then distinctness, which says the outcome values are distinct. So we're rejecting or putting to one side the notion of a measurement with, say, three possible outcomes, but where two of the outcomes have the same value associated with them. Repetition consistency is simply that when a measurement is performed, the same outcome is obtained. When a measurement is performed and then immediately repeated, the same outcome is obtained with certainty. And then classicality. Now, the idea there is that we want the measurements that we model in the quantum framework to be essentially just like the regular measurements we make in classical physics, Sturm-Yollak measurements, position measurements. We don't want auxiliary quantum systems to sneak into our definition of the measurement apparatus. We want to focus all of the non-classicality in the system itself. And then the interactions assume to have these two basic properties, that they're identity preserving, that the interactions preserve the identity of the system. So we want to rule out things like particle production and stuff like this. We want to be able to draw the boundary between the background and the system and maintain it for all time. This is the idealization. We make these assumptions all the time anyway. I mean, I'm just kind of articulating what the assumptions that we sort of tacitly make all the time when we use quantum theory. And finally, the internal dynamics of the background is assumed to be classically describable. So the electron, in electromagnetic field, the idea is that if we regard the electromagnetic field as the background of the electron, the background can be described using Maxwell's equations, but we'd have to use a quantum theory to describe the electron and its interaction with the background. Okay. The abstract experimental setup. Now, this is the basic structure of it. A source of systems, for example, an oven, an evaporator, which evaporates, say, silver atoms. A preparation device. So preparation is implemented using some measurement, A dash, which has N A dash possible outcomes. And the preparation selects only those systems which register outcome J. Interaction I occurs in the intervening time. And then measurement A is performed, which has NA dash possible outcomes. Now, when we ordinarily do an experiment, we ask for more than this. Typically, for example, we've got in our minds the idea that we want to, say, look at the spin degrees of freedom of an electron. That's what we want to study. So accordingly, we choose our preparation appropriately. We use Stern-Gerlach apparatus to prepare, and measurement A would be another Stern-Gerlach measurement, for example. So the idea here is that if we are going to do an experimental setup, we want, ideally, a preparation to give us maximum control of the degrees of freedom of the system, which encode the property of the system we're studying. Now, classical and quantum physics disagree about what constitutes an ideal preparation. So a position of preparation in quantum physics is ideal. But in classical physics, it's not. You need to prepare using a measurement which fixes the position and momentum of a particle. And moreover, the notion I'm using of an ideal preparation requires that we know what we mean by the state in the system, which is a theory-dependent notion. It's a fundamentally theoretic notion. So since we're assuming we don't know quantum theory, and we want to build up quantum theory, is there any way of finding out, operationally testing, whether a preparation is ideal without reference to the quantum formalism? And we turn very simply to the notion of the completeness of a preparation. So in classical physics, if a system undergoes an ideal preparation, the state of the system is now determined. And we just observe that once a system has been prepared in this way, then the results of subsequent measurements are independent of the history of the system prior to the interaction. So for example, we've got, let's say, a macroscopic body, and we're studying spatial behavior and electric field. We fix the position momentum at initial time. That fixes the state. We let it pass through a region where some potential is acting, and then we measure its position momentum at some later time. The results of that measurement are independent of anything we might do to the particle before the preparation, a very elementary observation. So we can say that the preparation, in this case, is complete with respect to the outcomes of the measurement. Now, the very nice thing is that an analogous situation occurs in quantum theory. So it's again a Stern-Gerlach experiment. This is the pre-preparation interaction with the system. This is the preparation device. This is the measurement. And quantum theory tells us that the probabilities, the outcome probabilities here, are independent of this interaction. It doesn't matter what we do with the particle here. The probabilities P1 and P2 are not changed. So analogously, in the quantum framework or in the quantum setting, we can say that preparation is complete with respect to the measurement, meaning precisely that the outcome probabilities of the measurement are unaffected by this pre-preparation interaction with the systems. And we can operationalize this very, very straightforwardly. So imagine we've got the abstract experimental setup, and we've got some preparation followed by interaction, followed by some measurement. And so the input state of the measurement, let's just abstractly call it S. And we can model the data obtained in N trials of the experiment by a probabilistic source with some probability N tuple P. And then we say that the preparation is complete with respect to the measurement A if P is independent of arbitrary pre-preparation interactions with the system. So this is just directly generalizing the idea of completeness. So intuitively, the preparation in this case will be providing us with maximal control over the degrees of freedom of the system, which encode the property that we're interested in. Now, okay, so the basic idea now is that we've got the idea of completeness, and we want to use that as a basis for honing in on what we mean by an abstract setup. So a useful idea here is the idea of property space. I'm speaking very roughly now just to communicate the ideas. Suppose you have an electron. It has spatial properties, it has spin properties. So we can think of a property space. So what I want to do is to define the idea that I've got two measurements, and they're looking at precisely the same region of property space of the system. For example, two Sternfeld-Eck measurements will be looking at precisely the same region of property space of the system. And operationally, I can express this idea by saying that if you have a preparation using measurement A dash, and then a measurement A, and the preparation is complete with respect to the measurement, and if the completeness holds even when I exchange A and A dash, then A and A dash form a measurement pair. So this is the idea. And so intuitively, again, they're looking at the same region of property space. And a very simple example, any two Sternfeld-Eck measurements form a measurement pair. And then we define a measurement set very simply. We say, suppose I have measurement A and it's looking at some region of property space, that I would like the set of all measurements that are looking at that region of property space. And I can define it simply as the set of all measurements that form a measurement pair with A, but they're not a composite of other measurements in A. And the example of Sternfeld-Eck measurements again, any given Sternfeld-Eck measurement generates a measurement set consisting of all Sternfeld-Eck measurements. And that set excludes composites of two or more successive Sternfeld-Eck measurements. So far we're focused on measurements. Now we want to express the idea of interactions. What are the allowable interactions? Okay. So we want to now find interactions that just are going to manipulate the spin degrees of freedom of the system. It's not going to say couple spatial and spin degrees of freedom of the system, like in the case of the electron. To ensure that, we just have to make sure that an interaction doesn't, as it were, spoil or the completeness of any preparation with respect to any measurement. Right? So again, in the spin-half system case, uniform B-field interactions with a spin-half system are completely fine. They're compatible with Sternfeld-Eck measurement set. But non-uniform B-field interactions are not compatible. Intuitively, we know that they couple spin and spatial degrees of freedom of the system. So those are excluded. And the interaction set I is simply defined as the set of all interactions compatible with the measurement set. And finally, sort of more a definition than anything else, I mean, almost a linguistic definition. So imagine that we've got, again, an electron with, say, spin and spatial degrees of freedom. You could have a measurement set consisting of all Sternfeld-Eck measurements. That's just looking at the spin degrees of freedom of the system. And you could have another set of measurements which are looking at the spatial behavior of the system. And those measurement sets are disjoint. And so we will say that if you have two experimental setups, both of which are looking at electrons, but where the measurement sets in the respective setups are disjoint, then the setups are also disjoint. So intuitively, these two setups are investigating distinct and disjoint aspects of the property space of the system. Now, the postulates.
Can I ask before we go? Can you make a distinction between the concept of state space that we have normally?
Sorry?
The concept of state space or
yeah.
And what you call the property space? Is it the same or different? Or?
I'm speaking deliberately intuitive terms. So I'm just saying that, that it's almost like when we theoretically model, say, a particle, right? We say we've got spatial degrees of spatial behavior, spin behavior. So at this point, I deliberately don't want to talk about state, because state is something much more specific. Yes, it's something, a mathematical object. It's very not trivial what the relationship would be between the state and the property space. I'm just using it as a way of speaking to communicate the ideas, really. Now, the postulates can be divided into three types, A, B, and C. Type A, they're based on classical physics. Either we take them unchanged or we modify them in a really straightforward way in light of experimental facts characteristic of quantum phenomena. The second, type B, are based on a classical quantum correspondence argument. So again, we're drawing them from classical physics into the quantum setting, but we are using a bridging principle. We're using a correspondence principle to do that. So A and B are both essentially, the postulates of type A and B essentially are classically derived. But the postulates of type C are novel in that they don't have any obvious classical counterpart or basis. And they're based on experimental facts that are characteristic of quantum phenomena and you know, special to the quantum setting, and all novel theoretical principles or ideas. And the postulates are organized in this manner into five main groups. The first group concern measurements, basic properties of measurements that we perform. And then the next level is what you say, well, how do you theoretically represent the state of the system? So the second group is concerning that. And then you would ask for, well, how do you represent interactions between the background and the system, or represent changes in the reference frame of the observer? And the third group concerned that. The fourth postulate is simply a consistency postulate, and postulate five concerns composite systems. How do we relate the states of subsystems to the state of the composite system? So now I'll briefly look at the postulates. And just first point out where they come from. It looks like a lot of postulates, but most of them are classically derived. You've got the ones highlighted now. They're directly obtained from classical physics. There are no surprises there. And the ones now in green are obtained via a correspondence principle from classical physics again. So it's the remaining ones, these four, which are, I call, novel. Although one could arguably say consistency is just a general theoretic principle. And so essentially the novel ones are 1.3, 2.2, and 2.3. So information, the principle of information gain comes in here. Now, postulate 1.1 is simply saying that when measurement A is performed, one of n possible outcomes is obtained. I should have said really that, okay, the abstract setup I had at the beginning, we just had measurement A, measurement A dash, and I didn't put any constraints on them. Now all of the postulates are referring to measurements A and A dash chosen from a measurement set. And the interactions involved are all from an interaction set, as I've defined them previously. So now, what's happening here is that postulate 1.1 is saying, the way that we've defined it, that all the measurements in the measurement set have the same number of possible outcomes, so that they can't have different number of possible outcomes. This is the key new idea of postulate 1.1. 1.2, perhaps unnecessarily, is repetition. It's saying that when measurement A is immediately repeated, the same outcome is observed with certainty. And it's just drawn directly from classical physics, and it's consistent with experimental findings and quantum experiments. And 1.3 now is the first novel assumption. Now, just to, before I go into it, in what we've said is that, say, a measurement set in the quantum setting will generally consist, would be an infinite set. So, for example, the set of all Stern-Gerlach measurements. If you carry out the analogous definitions in the classical setting, you find the measurement set only consists of one measurement. For example, if you're looking at the spatial behavior of a system, then there's only one measurement in that measurement set, and that is a measurement which measures the position and momentum of the particle. So you don't have any question. You simply need to write down the state in the classical framework relative to one measurement, the unique measurement. But in the quantum setting, we have a situation, the measurement set contains many measurements, and the easiest way to understand this postulate is really diagram. What it's asserting is that this is measurement A dash. input system, and this is the output, and this is the actual measured outcome. What it's asserting is that this box can be replaced by this box, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference insofar as the outcome and the output system are concerned. And it's inspired, really, by looking at Stern-Gerlach measurements. Again, if you have a Stern-Gerlach device in the z-direction, and if I wanted as an experimenter to make measurement in the x-direction instead, but if I were lazy, I could just leave it like that and then put two B-field interactions either side along the y-axis. And that would look exactly the same as the Stern-Gerlach device in this direction. So that's something that one can even see classically. Now to the states. Now, postulate 2.1 is asserting that the state of the system contains two n-tuples, the probability n-tuple, p1 through pn, and this chi n-tuple. Right? So in other words, what it's asserting is that the state doesn't contain just the probabilities p1 through pn, which is what you learn about when you do measurement A. There are also some variables you don't learn anything about. In a very simple way, you could understand this as an expression of a kind of principle of complementarity, so that there are degrees of freedom in the system that you don't know anything about when you do a measurement. Now, the precise form of this postulate is obtained from a correspondence argument, what I call a limit correspondence argument. Right? So, imagine that, to understand it, imagine an electron that is accelerated through some potential and passes through a submicron aperture, and then goes through a region where some potential is acting, and then is finally measured at the screen. Now, first of all, we find experimentally that the position preparation is actually complete with respect to the position measurement to a very high degree of precision. And so we can actually model this thing in the abstract idealized setup that I described already. Now, then we consider the thought experiment. What happens as m tends to macroscopic values? So imagine muon, proton, and going up, increasing the mass. What would happen? Well, we know what will happen. That experimentally, the nice diffraction pattern of the electron gradually collapses to a blob. So you in the end, end up with the classical predictions. But classical predictions of what? What's the classical model that we would use in that case? Well, the interesting thing is in this thought experiment is that the position preparation is still complete with respect to the measurement. It means that the outcomes of the position measurement are still probabilistic. So we still have a probabilistic element in here, even though we've gone to the classical limit. So what we need to do to describe this classically is use the ensemble model for the particle. So we would use the Hamilton-Jacobi model. And the Hamilton-Jacobi model, if we discretize it on lattice points in space, has the state, which I've written in abbreviated form as this, which expanded out, it basically contains probabilities p1 through pn, which are the probabilities that a particle will be found in region 1. And then these action variables, these local action variables, s1 through sn, and obviously these encode classically the energy and local momentum of the ensemble. And if we do the simplest thing possible, really, we insist on a one-to-one correspondence between the quantum and classical states, then the quantum state must look like that, where the chi I are real value degrees of freedom, and furthermore, that in the classical limit, the chi I and the si are related in this simple way. And alpha is there just to take care of dimensions. Now, what I mean by this is that this diagram commutes. That is to say, if this is the quantum state of the system in this consisting of, say, a particle, and we evolve this quantum using the quantum theory that we don't yet have, then we should get the same result if we dive down into classical physics, evolve using the Hamilton-Jacobi equations, and then go back up into the quantum realm. So this I call the limit correspondence principle, and we'll make repeated use of this to get a number of the other postulates.
Sorry, evolution, where does that come from? Because you have a discrete Hamiltonian
So the classical evolution then would be an appropriate discretized form of the Hamilton-Jacobi equations. Not happy.
Then do you have a model, or do you just, this is just a construction?
Well, I'm focusing attention now on a particle, so it's
no, I understand, yeah. But what I'm saying is that you have, I don't want to go too much, because probably the question can be asked further, but just a point that I would say that, do you actually have a model that how this happens, or you just postulate that based on some discretized assumptions underlying language?
I don't think I really understand.
Okay, I'll come back to it.
What do you mean by evolving using the Hamilton Jacobi? Do you mean using the Hamilton equations, or
Jacobi equations?
But that depends on a particular solution to them. I mean, there are many solutions.
Right. So you'd have to
have a unique evolution.
It's not unique in the sense, but you'd have to make the correspondence for our purposes. That non-uniqueness isn't the problem. All the properties that we want to... So the purpose of this diagram would be to take across the certain properties of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation into the quantum setting.
But so if you just say you love using Hamilton's equation, unless you have in mind some wave function, which is an angle limit, I don't understand what's gained by formulating it the way you did.
Can I come back to this a bit later? Is that okay? At the end. I have to think about it. Okay, so postulate 2.2 is, I'll say right at the beginning, the hard one to swallow, but on the other hand, I can't see any way of doing without it. And so what it's saying, so the idea is so far is, okay, let me just go past that. This is not very helpful. Postulate 2.2 is saying this. It's saying that when measurement A is performed, one of n possible outcomes is observed. But in addition, there are outcomes A or B, which are determined by, which have probabilities, P of A given I, P of B given I. And the outcome probabilities are determined, sorry, I need to go back now. So the outcome probabilities are basically a function of chi r. Okay, so that's the first assumption. And the second assumption is that, in addition, there are outcome values plus and minus, which are determined by the sign of the q variables. So let me try to explain where this comes from. So first of all, the outcomes A and B. The motivation there is the following, that postulate 2.1 is saying the state contains the p n-tuple and the chi n-tuple. So when we look at that state and we try to handle it theoretically, the problem is, well, what are these chi's? We can deal with probabilities, we can manipulate them, we can talk about information, but how do we deal with the chi's? We really can't go any further unless we can somehow make some assumption about what they are. And the very simplest assumption that one could make at this point is to assume that the chi I encode probabilities of some events. And simply to remain consistent with the fact that we don't see anything else, we have to assume that those outcomes are unobserved. So this is the very simple reason why it's done. And later on I'll talk about other arguments that makes this seem not so strange. And the introduction of the q variable, so you might say, well, why have I introduced these q's? That's motivated by looking at the polarization of a photon. So again, now looking at, I'm using quantum language here, but if you go to electromagnetism and look at polarization of a wave, the state of the wave with respect to just polarization behavior is given by a unit vector in space. And if we want to work out the probabilities that the wave, so now go to the photon picture, if you want the probabilities that a photon will pass through a polarizer, we would take the projection squared. And this state is really the fundamental object, and the probabilities are a secondary derived thing. And for example, if you wanted to superpose two waves with different polarizations, you would add the polarization vectors first before working out probabilities. So it seems that just by looking at electromagnetism, and you don't see this in classical mechanics anywhere, but when you look at electromagnetism, this introduces the idea that the probabilities aren't really the fundamental thing. It's actually something more basic. And that bit more basic thing are these Q variables. So each of these goes between plus or minus one, and you square them up to get probabilities. Right. So postulate 2.3 is finding where information enters. And it asserts that when you do measurement A on a system in an unknown state S, the amount of information that what you gain about the system is independent of S in the limit as n tends to infinity. So the rationale for it is as follows. Imagine that you've got two experimental trials, each consisting of n runs, differing only in that measurement A is performed here and measurement A dash is performed here. So in other words, we're trying to gain information about S of t, but by doing two different measurements. Now, by postulate 1.3, representation of measurements, we can replace the box containing measurement A with this box, interaction I followed by measurement A. And we can not write down interaction I dash because we don't care about the outcome system. We only care about the data. So in other words, the statistical properties of the data will be unchanged by making this substitution. And now I'm simply separating off the interaction and the measurement. So we have this box. We have this diagram here. And so let me just go back here. So basically what I'm trying to say is that we've transformed the original two trials into these two trials. Now, suppose that we're going back to the original two trials now. Suppose that this yields more information about S of t in n runs than this one. Well, then that would imply that one of the measurements, A and A dash, is privileged insofar as the amount of information it yields about S. Now, that's not an impossible possibility, but we just make the assertion that it's not the case. We make the assertion that no measurement in the measurement set A is informationally privileged. But that implies that measurement A yields the same amount of information about S and about S dash. So postulate 2.3, by ensuring that S and S dash, that we gain about the same amount of information about S and S dash, ensures that measurements A and A dash yield the same amount of information about the state. So the key idea here, it's actually less easy to follow this argument than I would have hoped. The basic idea is that measurements A and A dash are looking, as it were, at the same system, but from different points of view. And we're trying to say that even though they're different perspectives, they're actually informationally equivalent. So that one doesn't yield more information than the other. You just get different perspectives on the same thing. Now, postulate 2.4 is based on the limit correspondence principle again. And we simply use the fact that in the discrete Hamilton-Jacobi model, we can add the constant S0 to each of the SI without changing the predictions of the model in any way. And this implies that if we wish to assign a prior probability over the SI, that this condition must hold. Because if it were not to hold, we're trying to say that there's some physical difference between this group of SI and this group of SI. So we can't have that. And from this condition, one can derive very easily that the prior over SI is uniform. And under the classical quantum correspondence that I described before, it follows that prior over chi I is uniform. So which is postulate 2.4. Now to transformations. postulates 3 and 3.1 are drawn directly from classical physics and simply saying that translations...
When you say uniform, with respect to what measure? Are these chi's supposed to live in a vector space?
Or no, just each one. So chi 1 is just a real number.
So they live in a real number. So the particular parameterization is important.
Yes.
I mean, J sub x and J sub x squared would have a difference.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how do you know? So you just postulate that there's some...
Well, no, you see, what I'm exploiting is the fact that our starting point is we know about the Hamilton-Jacobi model. So this is the inference from the Hamilton-Jacobi model. Okay? And then we already postulated this classical quantum correspondence. And from this immediately follows that the prior over chi I is uniform.
Okay, I don't understand why the Hamilton... why the Hamilton-Jacobi model gives a vector space structure on the variables.
Okay. Are you happy with...
a manifold, but not in general a vector space.
Are you happy with the fact that the zero value of the SI is physically irrelevant in the Hamilton-Jacobi model?
No, I don't understand it. I don't know what is meant by the zero value.
Oh, okay. What I mean is that in the Hamilton-Jacobi model, you...
Maybe you covered it before.
I don't know if I did. Well,
okay, so then why don't you...
I'm just using basic properties of it. So in the Hamilton-Jacobi model, the Hamilton-Jacobi state is just given by this thing here, right? In the continuum form of it. And this gives the probability density over space. And this, from this, you can derive the local momenta, grad s, and ds by dt is telling you the energy. So the thing is, if I could add a constant to that s function, this function here, and it doesn't change this or this, this corresponds to the momentum. And this corresponds to energy. So you can see that, so the zero value, I could lift all of these up or push them all down, it doesn't change the values of these. These are the only things that are physically significant.
So this S's represent the value of the Hamilton-Jacobi function at different points of phase space?
So basically what I'm saying, this is now in continuum form defined over all space. And in the discretized form, we just take it over a lattice, for example. We just discretize it on a lattice, a spatial lattice.
But how can you be sure? I mean, you have to have a model, discrete model, because here we can understand this in the continuum that this evolves.
Right.
Here, do you actually have a model to show this is true?
Are you saying that the step from the continuum to the discretized form?
What I'm saying is that it's like you're assuming it, but when you show this, it actually works. Just like in continuum. There we have a complete theory, you can be sure that this what you just said is true.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do is trying to pull some feature of classical physics across the quantum setting. So I'm going to be making a big assumption that will still hold. But I'm trying to use some kind of bridging principle to help me bring it across. So in a classical setting, we know this invariance property holds. And it gives a definite prior over the SI. And then I'm saying that we can use a classical quantum correspondence to bring that over into the quantum setting.
The status here is that this is a way of motivating the postulate.
Yes.
Not so to speak, deriving
it. I'm not trying to derive it. I can't. It's an inductive process. I'm trying to say this is how you can understand it. This is where it comes from.
I still don't see that this follows. By uniform, you mean independent? It's uniform under independent variations of the SI?
Yes.
But all you've showed is that it's unchanged by adding the same constant to all of the SIs. That's a much weaker statement.
Yeah. Okay, well.
Obviously, the relative values of the SIs do matter.
Yeah, the relative.
They affect the gradient.
Yeah, so I was trying to say, suppose I choose S1, S2 through SN. then this is equal to this, irrespective of the value of S0.
Yeah.
So then that whole thing holds for all S, S sub 0, and for all Si. I mean, it will also then hold for A.
It doesn't follow that if I change S1 and leave S2 and S3 all the same, that the probability doesn't change.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So you're not claiming that?
No, I'm not saying that. So basically, I mean...
It's a uniform.
Yeah, in the simplest case, if you've got probability...
Well, that's still the margin of the uniform. It's for example, just the prior
one.
What? It's the marginal distributions that...
Yeah, I'm working out marginal distributions. So in the one-dimensional case, if somebody asserts that, then it follows that the prior of X is uniform. Right. If I do it in the two-dimensional case...
It's only for each...
Yeah, only for each one.
The marginals, as people were saying.
The marginals, yes. Yeah, just the marginals. So the probability over the prior over S1 is uniform, the prior of S2 is uniform, not some vector. Yeah. I'm trying to remember whether I got this one. Okay. So again, I'm trying to use this idea that the S value, the zero value of the Si doesn't physically matter. So I'm just repeating what I've said more or less here, that you've got the initial state, classically now. We evolve it using the Hamilton-Jacobi equations, we get that state. But if we were to add S sub zero to each of the Si to get that state, and evolve using the Hamilton-Jacobi equations to get this state, we would find that the PI double dash and the PI dash agree. And I'm simply going to take this across into the quantum framework using the classical quantum correspondence here. So in the quantum picture, I'm going to assert that this holds, this diagram commutes. Actually not commutes, that these PI dash and these PI double dash are also equal in the quantum setting. So that is actually the content of postulate 3.2. And postulate 3.3 is simply adopted unchanged from classical physics. It's most easily illustrated by a couple of examples. A reflection rotation of a frame of reference through an angle theta is continuously dependent upon theta. So the map must also be continuously dependent upon theta. Rotation of a frame of reference through an angle theta is a continuous transformation. For value theta equals zero, the map becomes the identity. So basically, postulate 3.3 is just asserting this is the case in general. Postulate 3.4 is a consistency postulate, again, most easily described by this diagram. There are two different processes that I'm going to look at, this one and this one. We imagine we have a system in state S. We transform it using some map M, and then we perform an experiment consisting of, we perform N experiments where in each experiment we perform a measurement on the system, let's say measurement A, and we obtain some posterior probability distribution over the state space. But we could also do it this way. We could do the measurements on system in state S, get a distribution over the state space, and then transform that across to here using the map M star, which is actually determined by map N. Postulate 4 is asserting this diagram commutes in the limit as n tends to infinity. So in the limit when all the statistical fluctuations can be neglected, this diagram commutes. And postulate 5 is again drawn from the limit correspondence principle. So imagine that you've got a particle and you have one model where you're just concerning yourself with the x position and x momentum of the system. So you'd write down Hamilton-Jacobi model with Hamilton-Jacobi state like that. And let's suppose for the same particle you also concerned yourself with the y behavior of the system. The Hamilton-Jacobi state would look like that. And then let's suppose you said, I want to consider the behavior of the system in the xy plane. And then the Hamilton-Jacobi model would have a state which looks like that. And if we know these two states, it follows from the Hamilton-Jacobi equations that the state of the composite system is given by this. This part is obvious, that you just multiply probabilities. But this part is not so obvious, and it comes directly from the Hamilton-Jacobi equations. So again, under the classical quantum correspondence, the quantum state would have to do this. And postulate 5 is then generalizing that to the abstract case of an arbitrary quantum system. Now, the deduction itself, I'll have to skip through this reasonably quickly, but the key step really is step one, implementing the principle of information gain. This really provides the backbone for the quantum formalism. The step two is to represent state as a unit vector in a two-dimensional Euclidean space. And step three is then to find how do you represent mappings of the state space. Step four, how do you represent different measurements in the measurement set? And five is to obtain a tensor product rule. In later steps, which I don't discuss today in this talk, after formulating another correspondence principle, the average value correspondence principle, it's possible to derive the precise form of the temporal evolution operator and also to obtain all of the formal rules that you need to model typical physical systems, such as the canonical commutation relations. Now, we've said that when we make measurement A, there are 2n possible outcomes, so like 1a, 1b, and so on. And the n-tuple, which describes that, is given by this. It's got 2n probabilities in it, which are defined in this way, directly taken from the tree. Now, the principle of information gain is saying that when we make measurement A, the amount of information we gain about P is independent of P in the limit as n tends to infinity. So to implement this condition, it's necessary to look at the process by which we gain information about a probabilistic source. So let's consider the simplest possible case. This is now nothing to do with quantum theory, it's just probability theory and information theory. So we have a probabilistic source with two possible outcomes. We interrogate it n times to obtain this data string. And then we ask simply, how much information does the data provide about P1? The calculation we do has three steps. First of all, from Dn, we recognize that it's only the frequency of the outcomes 1 and 2 that really matters. And so we extract F1, frequency of outcome 1. Then we use Bayes' rule to calculate the posterior probability distribution over P1, which is just given by this, where I symbolizes the knowledge that the experimenter has or had just before starting to obtain the data, just before starting the interrogation. And then, number three, we calculate the information gain, which we define as initial uncertainty about P1 minus final uncertainty about P1, which is standard definition in information theory. Now, we choose to quantify the uncertainty using the Shannon-James entropy, which is just the continuum form of the Shannon, discrete Shannon entropy. And what that says is that if one's uncertainty about P1 is given by, sorry, if one's knowledge about P1 is given by the probability distribution, probability density function F, then the uncertainty that one has about F is given by this integral here. So here you have the F log F thing, which is very familiar from the discrete Shannon entropy. The really new aspect is this prior probability over P1. And using this formula, the information gain is given by this integral here. And one can see, the most notable feature here is that it depends explicitly on what that prior happens to be. But what should we choose for the prior? Here, probability theory falls silent. It doesn't give a general method for assigning priors, and according to practitioners in the subject in Bayesian probability theory, it shouldn't, because it depends on what we mean by I. We have to formalize I. Let's try, though, to use a uniform prior. In that case, the information delta k contains two terms, one which just monotonically increases with n, and one which is dependent upon p1. So what we're finding here is that the amount of information that one obtains is actually dependent upon p1, contrary to the principle of information gain. So our only freedom in all of this calculation is the prior. So we can ask the question, well, is there a prior that I can choose such that the information gain becomes independent of P1? And the answer is yes, it's that prior there, which may look, I guess, unfamiliar, but it's actually quite well known in Bayesian probability theory. It was suggested by Harold Jeffries over 60 years ago. And this argument readily generalizes to an M outcome probabilistic source, and this is the key factor, just 1 over the square root of the product of the PIs. And we can visualize this prior very nicely as follows. If we define the variables Q1 and Q2 to be positive square roots of P1 and P2 respectively, we find that the prior over the P1, P2 transforms to a prior over Q1, Q2, which is actually constant on Q1 squared plus Q2 squared equals 1. So if we define the Euclidean space Q2, we can show that we can equivalently represent the prior as a uniform prior over the quadrant, the positive quadrant of the unit circle. And furthermore, the calculation shows that the posterior, meaning that is, we make n measurements and we have a posterior, that posterior has standard deviation 1 over 2 square root of n. In other words, the posterior has a standard deviation which is independent of q. Q can be anywhere, but the posterior is unchanged. And in the m-dimensional case, we just go to a unit hypersphere where the prior is uniform over the positive orthot, and the posterior is a symmetric Gaussian with the same standard deviation. So what are the implications of information gain for us?
It does seem to be a key point I didn't understand. When you say it's independent of Q, what do you mean? It's independent of the outcome?
Okay.
Q is a random variable.
All right, so the idea is that, so imagine I've got a probabilistic source, P1 and P2, and I can tune the values of P1 and P2, for example, all the way from a very fair, representing a very fair coin to a very biased coin, right? And if I then sort of toss this 100 times, so let's say a fair coin and a biased coin, and I toss them both 100 times, I can write down a posterior probability distribution over P1 in both cases. And what we're trying to say here is that if you switch to the Q variables, Q1 and Q2, then the posterior probability distribution has the same standard deviation in both cases. And this, yes, it is very significant. The significance kind of comes later.
Yeah. But then why would you assume that? You're saying no matter what the underlying...
I'm not assuming it. It actually comes from the calculation.
No, I know, but I mean, you're going to use this prior, aren't you, that comes out of this?
Yes, and so what I'm trying to say then is...
So it's a basic principle that sort of no matter what the underlying model is, the amount of information you get should be the same. Is that sort of the idea?
The idea is that it doesn't matter what the... So in that 2n dimension, that probability tree with 2n leaves, it doesn't matter what the p tilde, what the probability n tuple is, the amount of information that you'll gain in n trials, in the asymptotic limit, is independent of p tilde.
Yeah.
So, and that I'm trying to say is that's what forces us to choose the prior that we've found. That's the only freedom we have. Okay.
This is some sort of sneaking in a Hilbert space norm, it looks to me.
No, I'm not sneaking it in, I'm simply I'm defining Euclidean space and I'm saying
I know, but I mean, it's a question of motivation of this postulate.
Right. So if we then apply postulate 2.4, which is basically that saying that prior over chi I is uniform, and then use these connections which have been postulated in 2.2, we find that these functions f and f tilde are actually determined. They're basically the trigonometric functions cos chi I and sine chi I. Now, if we, so far we've restricted Q to just the positive orthont of the unit hypersphere, but if we allow all Q in the unit hypersphere, we can encode the signs of the QA given I and the QB given I as well. In other words, if you've got the unit hypersphere, the orthont that you're in tells you about the signs of the QA given I and B given I. And the actual, when you square up each of the values, each of the Q values, you get the probabilities, you get the 2n probabilities. In other words, we have a way of representing the whole of the state space in terms of q vectors in this on this unit hypersphere. So now, using the functions f and f tilde just derived, we can write down the state in this way. So you can explicitly see the dependence on the probabilities and on the chi variables. And the prior in this extended space is also uniform. So the prior is uniform there over the whole unit hypersphere. And the posterior consists of a symmetric Gaussian over one orthont and zero everywhere else. Now, to find the possible set mappings of state space, we use a number of postulates. 3.3 and 3.1 say that the mapping is 1 to 1. And postulate 4 fixes the set of possible transformations to orthogonal transformations. Postulate 3.2 restricts the set of possible orthogonal transformations. And finally, we can show in step 4 that the set of transformations we then have is equivalent to the set of all unitary and anti-unitary transformations on a suitably defined complex vector space. So I'll have to skip through this, I'm afraid, for time reasons. But implementation of postulate 4, the key idea is that we now know, because of the information principle, that we've got a symmetric Gaussian over one orthont here, and a symmetric Gaussian over one orthont here. And the map that takes us from here to here, it's straightforward to show that it has to be an orthogonal transformation. I mean, intuitively, you've got a symmetric Gaussian and a symmetric Gaussian. A reflection rotation will take one to the other. Anything else will distort the Gaussian, or will distort at least one Gaussian distribution. So once we've restricted ourselves to orthogonal transformations, we can implement postulate 3.2. So it means that if in this state we add a constant to each of these chi i's, then it won't change the predictions of the model. And the basic algebra shows that M therefore must have this form. It must form this sort of a two-n-dimensional matrix consisting of 2 by 2 submatrices. And so this submatrix here is an enlargement reflection rotation matrix if sigma ij is equal to -1, and it's an enlargement rotation matrix if sigma ij is equal to 1. And so the constraint is that M must have this form where all of these tij are either scale rotations or scale reflection rotations. And then we can take the step of showing that we actually have the quantum formalism at this point, essentially. We define the complex vector in this way, the V, and we consider this transformation here, where capital V is a complex n-dimensional matrix. And if we set Vij to be this, we find the resulting transformation is identical to that produced by N, with the non-zero Tij being scale rotations. And the orthogonality of N implies that V is unitary. And similarly, if we consider the transformation produced by Vk, where K is the complex conjugation operation, that's identical to N with the non-zero Tij being scale reflection rotations. And we can show the converse is also true. Every unitary or anti-unitary transformation can be in the CAS in the form of the matrix M satisfying postulate 3.2. So we can establish this one-to-one correspondence. And in steps 4, we find the representation of measurements using postulate 1.3. So this is what postulate 1.3 now looks like. I won't go through the derivation, it's very straightforward, but one finds that one can find this U and V very easily by considering some simple cases, and therefore find a Hermitian representation of measurement A dash. And then the tensor product rule follows very easily. This is what postulate 5 is saying. If we simply express all the states in complex form, we find that the state of the composite system can be simply written as V1 tensor V2. So to conclude with some general remarks, in the process we've obtained a mathematical structure that's neither more nor general than the finite dimensional quantum formalism. So consequently, it provides a pretty good laboratory for testing proposed modifications of quantum formalism. If someone proposes a non-unitary modification of quantum theory, you can trace back and say which of the postulates need to be changed in order for that to be the case. Or conversely, more creatively, you could try changing the postulates and seeing what impact that has on the quantum formalism. One can also have a look at issues that have been raised by some quantum gravity theorists and say, some of whom have said, well, the quantum formalism may not be applicable in the unchanged form in a quantum gravity theory. So again, one could look at that in a more systematic way. We see that complex numbers arise in conjunction with unitary anti-unitary transformations. They arise all at once, both together, as a result of imposing this invariance postulate 3.2. So this bears on the idea that we could keep the quantum formalism, but just allow non-unitary transformations. From the point of view of the derivation, that would seem to be a very questionable thing to do. It may be right, but from this point of view, it looks quite questionable. And we see that the concept of information plays a central role. It gives rise to this Q space, which introduces real amplitudes. It gives rise to sinusoidal functions F and F tilde, which through the complexification gives rise to the e to the I phis and so on that we're familiar with. And the restriction that the mapping M is an orthogonal transformation of Q space is only one step removed from the idea that transformations are represented by unitary or anti-unitary transformations. And another interesting point is the idea that the notion of a prior plays such an important role in this derivation, which I think is relatively underappreciated in other approaches. And finally, that the approach makes it rather clear which assumptions are shared with classical physics, which are modifications of classical ideas, and which are really novel. And really, the only new ingredient is information. And very, very briefly, postulate 2.2, the unobservability of A and B. How can we understand it? Well, at least it makes sense in a certain sense, because for a system in an eigenstate of energy E, we know from the temporal evolution operator that the quantum state's overall phase changes at this rate. And if we want a measurement to resolve it on the A and B, it must have temporal resolution at least as good as this. But if we allow ourselves to use the energy-time uncertainty relation, it follows that the energy associated with the measurement is of the order of the rest energy of the system. So if you had any such measurement that could resolve A or B, it would actually not preserve the identity of the system, as is required by the idealizations that we've made.
What does A and B mean?
A and B are these outcomes that are objectively realized, but I postulated that they're unobserved. So here I'm saying, well, is there any way that, does it make any sense? Is it internally consistent? So this is an argument to say that, well, it makes some sense. Essentially, the probabilities associated with them are changing so rapidly that you couldn't actually fix them with a measurement.
I'm not quite sure what thing is. Are you assuming that a measurement of the energy in a short time has to change the energy of the system? Or I'm not sure I'm reading that right.
I'm trying to say that.
But that's not true. That fact itself is not.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean. I mean, I'm just saying we've got a system in some state of energy. We write down the quantum state for it.
But what does it mean, the energy associated with the measurement?
Yeah, well, this I'm using quite loose language here because I can't be more precise, because we're going outside now of the quantum framework to even talk about such measurements. So the idea, that's why I said I'm allowing myself to use the energy time uncertainty relation in a sort of, you know, hand-waving kind of way and saying, well, if we interpret this as saying that a measurement with temporal resolution delta t must have an associated energy of delta e, of at least delta e, then we can make this argument.
Is delta e attributed to the measured system or to the
It's attributed to the interaction that must occur between the measurement device and the system.
But you're using it to say that it distributes the energy of the measuring system.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's not true in ordinary quantum mechanics. But it's often said to be true, but it's not true.
I know there's kind of controversy on this point. This is why I think, you know, one should take this with a pinch of salt. I mean, I understand. I know that there's quite a... But I think it's a bit more of a debate rather than there's a definite position, at least from what I've read. I mean, it seems like people go back and forth, and Aronoff wrote a paper at one point when he said, Bowman Aronoff wrote a paper at some point where they said it was the case, and at some point later it wasn't. And then Aronoff more recently has started to reinvestigate it. So what I mean is I think it's still in flux. So anyway, just here's it's a semi-quantitative argument, I mean, just a hand-waving kind of argument. And information, now, this is it. So I just wanted to point out that this information gain condition has many connections to other results of probability theory and information theory and to other informational approaches. First of all, it gives rise, it's equivalent to Jeffrey's rule for assigning prior probabilities. And Jeffrey's rule is a very general rule that was proposed, I think about 60 years ago. And it's used extensively in econometrics and other places in Bayesian probability theory. So the information gain condition actually does reproduce a result that is actually known and is used. The other interesting point is the metric over Q space is equivalent to the Fisher information metric, which is this one here, which is interesting in itself, but also because Fisher information is actually being used by some physicists to understand quantum theory, such as Fried and Reginato. And finally, the information gain condition implies the amount of information gained from a source after n interrogation increases monotonically with n in the limit as n tends to infinity, which intuitively makes sense, and is a principle that's actually been stated independently by Sumhammer in a different form, and Grinbach also. Thank you.
So people have tried to formulate quaternionic quantum mechanics and real quantum mechanics. Can you pinpoint in this where that possibility has got from?
Well, you see, the thing is that, in a sense, to try to fix the number field is the purpose of this limit correspondence principle. So there, I'm saying that the number field isn't some arbitrary thing. I mean, there's real physics there. But in a Hamilton-Jacobi model, the state is given by P, PI, comma, SI. So there are these SI there. And when we try to formulate quantum theory to maintain a one-to-one correspondence, we have this number, we have this pair, P, comma, chi. And it's really that basic step, together with other postulates, which then gives rise to the complex number field having such an importance. So
when you said someone had a different series could go back and see what would.
Right.
Well, so you're saying what would have to change at the very beginning.
Yeah.
This Hamilton-Jacobi starting point wouldn't be appropriate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so in some cases you'll have to change something so basic. Another example actually is perhaps non-unitary transformations, that you can actually look at the postulates and see what the minimum changes that you could make. And the minimum change is to get rid of postulate 3.2, which is the invariance postulate, which is based on the zero value of the SI not being physically relevant. So you could keep all of the postulates unchanged, just as it were, remove that, and then you'd end up straight away with a class of non-unitary transformations that you could then go on and study, potentially. So in some cases, it's actually very potentially very useful. In some cases, it may not be at all.
And also, what about other things that aren't just part of, completely different
quantum
systems, people study.
Right. No. Well, so the formula. Okay. I think I haven't made the distinction clear enough. The thing I'm trying to do here is to derive the abstract quantum formalism without reference to a particular physical system. But the postulates that I've used, many of them, I'm actually the postulates of type B, right, which have been obtained from motivated by the Hamilton-Jacobi model. So in other words, some of the postulates are actually being motivated by properties of specific classical systems, but the postulates themselves that I've stated are general.
Okay. There's a time which probably stop there. It looks around until Friday.
First.
First. Okay.